Grade 6 Conference, Lecture 59, Clovis and Muhammad. Looking at the life of Clovis in the 5th century, we can get a feeling for this youthful and vibrant spirit that Rudolf Steiner identifies as being such an essential quality of the barbaric tribes that were now settling down and taking up the mantle of ancient Rome. So Clovis, at age 15 only, became king of the Franks. Now think of that, sixth graders. Some of you are nearly 13. Could you imagine yourselves in 2 years becoming not only a king who sits on a throne and has advisors and courtiers helping him out, but what it meant to be a king in those days was to be a warrior, to lead your troops very often directly into battle. Where did he learn how to do that? And where did he learn how to lead and guide men? We don't know really all that much about him. But throughout the Middle Ages, and even quite later, even really until the 19th century, we will hear again and again about men and sometimes women who at a very young age, because of the responsibilities of their inherited positions, such as being a prince, a princess, a king, or a queen, are suddenly in a position of great leadership and great responsibility, and often whose lives are quite threatened. So just think about that. You know, you guys have it really easy compared to what it meant to be someone your age not that long ago. So Clovis was fine being king. He was pagan, he was fierce, he was ambitious, and he was determined to subdue the tribes all around him and to make for himself a real kingdom. And this is, of course, in the midst of the darkness, the heavy forests, the uncharted lands of Central Europe. So he first conquered the last Roman governor of Gaul. So Rome, the city itself, was under ceaseless siege and invasion. It was really breathing its last gasp. And so it was true of the provinces as well. He took possession of the capital, Soissons. And I should mention that Clovis was, his own tribe was the Franks, also called the Freemen. And they were a very, very powerful tribe. They already had a reputation for fierceness and conquest. And they had taken possession of a good part of Gaul, which, as we know, Caesar himself had brought under Roman domination years before. So in honor of the Franks, the name of the country was changed from Gaul to France. And Clovis is one of the first real French heroes, heroes of the French people. So he wasn't happy with just taking over the capital, of overcoming the Roman governor. He also wanted to subdue the Visigoths and the Burgundians, very formidable tribes. Now, he had heard that the king of Burgundy had a niece named Clothilde, and he thought, if she's beautiful, if she's worthy of my affection, then I will marry her and I'll unite the two kingdoms that way. But how could he possibly court her when he and her uncle were incredible enemies? So he hatched a plan at about age 16. He gave a ring to Aurelian, who was one of his courtiers, and he told him to go in disguise to Geneva, which is in present-day Switzerland, and there to seek Clothilde. And Aurelian would have to make the judgment. Is she beautiful or not? Is she somebody that Clovis could really admire? So you see what it meant in days when there were no photographs, there were no Facebook pages to look at, where at best, as times would go on, you'd be able to get an artist to sketch your potential fiancé, and then you'd have to trust that artist. But he trusted Aurelian's judgment, so Aurelian disguised himself as a beggar. He knocked at Clotilde's door, so even though she was of the nobility, she lived a fairly simple life. Things had not yet gotten very grandiose in Europe at all. She saw a beggar at the door. She invited him to enter, and she washed his feet because she was Christian, and there was the spirit of hospitality and the spirit of serving others that lived very strongly in her. Well, she turned out to be very beautiful. And while no one else was listening, Aurelian whispered in her ear the message of Clovis. As it turned out, Clotilde was delighted. And she at once sent her ring to Clovis via Aurelian. And she told him that if he wished to have her, he must carry her away immediately. So Clovis managed to do this. He married Clotilde, and then immediately was free to make war on her uncle. I don't know why marriage had to precede that, but that's the way it worked in those times. And he conquered him and won the province of Burgundy, known to this day as one of France's richest farming districts. And then he didn't want to see the Visigoths in possession of any part of this central area of the old Gaul, so he conquered them as well. And this just went on, conquest after conquest. And just to see how, you know, how things worked out, you can feel the fairy tale quality to this. This is basically a verifiable, documented historical story, but you see where the fairy tales come from. These people really were acting still with a kind of divine quality about them. You know, miracles could really happen. So Clovis took the city of Reims, which at that time was not much more than a village, but it did have its own lovely church. And of course, you conquered any place. Even the church was up for grabs. So the spoils were brought from the church, quite a few valuable things, some of them undoubtedly put together or from melted Roman gold that might have gone back to conquests of 1,000 years before that. They were looking over the booty of war, and the bishop begged that just one beautiful chalice might be spared for the service of the altar. Now remember, Clovis was a pagan, so he didn't really care much about the service at the altar, but he felt for the bishop and said yes. Now it was the custom that everything would be divided by lot in those days. So Clovis turned to his chiefs, the men who had helped fight with him, and he begged them that before the division was made, they should all let the bishop have his chalice. Everybody agreed to this but one, and this man brought down his battle axe right upon the cup, shattered it, and exclaimed, "I do not consent. All shall share alike." Which was perfectly acceptable, and that was the way things were done. Clovis was asking for something exceptional to be done, that there be a quality of mercy and understanding, and this man who was of the old school was perfectly justified in shattering it like that. Well, Clovis just let that go. About a year later, he had a grand review of all of his troops and his nobles and those who had sworn allegiance to him. And the soldiers all showed up to present their spears and swords and show that they were ready for renewed battles. But the man of the split chalice appeared with a soiled and rusty battle axe. Clovis looked at it, threw it on the ground. While the man stooped down to get it, Clovis raised his own battle axe and cut the man in two, and said simply, "Thus didst thou cleave the chalice at Rheims." End of story. There we go. So Clotilde could see that there was, in spite of the fact that he liked to chop his men in half, she could feel that there was some Christian potential in Clovis, that his high spirits, in a way, could be channeled in perhaps a more constructive direction. And he had marched against a tribe of Alemanni. Alemannia, you remember, means Germany. And he was not doing very well. For the first time, Clovis was not winning the day. And one of his leaders came up to him after a very difficult battle that did not go well and said to him, "My lord, there is no hope for us now, but in the God of our Queen Clotilde." And Clovis is said to have fallen on his knees, looking into heaven, crying out, "Christ Jesus, I've called upon my gods, and they have withdrawn from me. God of my wife Clotilde, help me." The battle turned, and Clovis gained the victory. Sound familiar, huh? Here we have it again, this seeing Christ as the warrior God, because these people were all warriors. They were, you know, a few years before, they were being led by Thor and Odin to victory. Now that was the way they would perceive the Lord of Clotilde as well. And he then went to Rheims, and their preparations were made for his baptism. So he had, you know, attempted to do a good deed for the bishop there, and they liked him, they understood him. On the road from the palace to the chapel, the houses were hung with banners, and the streets were redolent with perfume. This was a very great moment, when a pagan king was going to become Christian. The clergy led the way. They carried the Gospels, a rare book to be seen, and the cross. Notice the cross has now become the symbol of Christianity, just 100 years after Constantine. The bishop followed, leading Clovis by the hand. And then came Clotilde, and the chiefs, his warriors, and she led them in singing hymns together. This was so beautiful, unlike anything that Clovis had ever seen before. He turned to the bishop and said, "Are you leading me to the King of Heaven? Are we in the Kingdom of Heaven?" And the bishop replied, "No, but this is the beginning of the road to the Kingdom of Heaven." And when the bishop was baptizing Clovis, he looked to the king as the king knelt before him and said, "Burn thou which thou hast worshipped, and worship that which thou hast burned." And Clovis, actually, it is said, was anointed with oil that was sent from heaven for his baptism. So we can see that the gates of the heavens and the earth hadn't quite closed, that people could still perceive the miraculous around them, or at least fervently believe in it. And in fact, the veil of oil is still said to be a sacred relic in Rheims. And the oil from it has been used at the coronation of all of the French kings, right up to the time of the French Revolution. We're going to learn more about that in eighth grade. And then Clovis was baptized. Now, you can imagine the group soul quality that still existed in these tribal relationships. Though he was a king, he was also a tribal leader. He was also related to everybody among his people. So the day that he was baptized, the same rite was held to 3,000 of the Franks, men, women, and children. And he was hailed as the most Christian king. And he received from the emperor of Constantinople, so now the real seat of Roman power is in the east, he was given a golden crown and the purple robe of a consul. So we still see, you know, Rome living on in this Christianity. And then he became the first of what was to be called the Merovingian line of kings, one of the most powerful lines in the early Middle Ages. He continued to fight, and interestingly, he overcame one Celtic tribe. Their name was the Parisi, and their greatest treasure was their little town of mud huts plastered with clay and thatched with straw. And he made this town his capital, known today as Paris, or Paris, of course. And he died in Paris in 511, and he left his Frankish kingdom to be divided among his four sons. And as the story goes again and again, very rarely in this hereditary line do the sons ever measure up to the father. There are some exceptions to this, but again and again, the sons themselves start to battle over the kingdom, and this results in the endless ups and downs of large kingdoms being subdivided into smaller ones, and fights arising between brothers. We'll see in 7th and 8th grade this same drama being repeated again and again. And now we'll go on in the next lecture to hear a very different life, that of Muhammad.